Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. President Donald Trump's decision to end the DACA program made national headlines this week, and about 400 people in New Hampshire may be affected. New information about out-of-state voter data in New Hampshire becomes fodder for right-wing fears about illegitimate voters. And Corey Lewandowski heads to Harvard. Lots of news to unpack this week, and we can't do it without your help. What about these stories do you want to know? What other stories still leave you with questions? You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. And here to talk about the week's news and answer your questions are Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU and author of the website NH Political Capital, and Dan Barrick, NHPR News Director and by phone reporter Mark Hayward of the Union Leader. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being on the show today.
Good morning.
Thanks, Peter.
And we're going to start the show today by talking about DACA and what the end of it means for folks here in New Hampshire. If you are one of the 400 or so dreamers, give us a call. Let us hear your perspective. 1-800-892-6477. Of course, we'd like to hear from anybody who has questions or comments about this, but dreamers, especially if you're out there, give us a call. Let us know what your perspective is. And by the way, as with every weekly New Hampshire News Roundup, we are live streaming video of us here in the studio on our Facebook page. So go to NHPR Exchange and you can leave your comments there as well. And of course, just watch and enjoy as this radio show gets made. All right, so let's talk about DACA. So the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program is coming to an end in 6 months unless Congress can come up with some legislative solution. Before we dive into what's happening right now with DACA, Dean, bring us up to speed on DACA's history. So when was DACA created and why?
Well, your listeners may remember something called the DREAM Act. It was a piece of legislation that was proposed by the Obama administration in 2007 and again in 2011. And this deals with children who are brought into the country illegally through no decision of their own and the question of how you deal with them in terms of their ability to work and go to school while dealing with the potential threat of deportation. So the Obama administration proposed legislation to deal with this issue in 2007 and 2011. Both times, it failed to overcome a Senate filibuster. You need 60 votes in the Senate. It's called a cloture vote to shut off debate and move to a vote. The administration was unable to get that out of Congress. So in June of 2012, President Obama issued an executive order essentially setting up what we know now as DACA, which is to give childhood arrivals a 2-year renewable permit to prevent deportation and also a work permit. So that's the history of the legislation, is these repeated attempts by the Obama administration to deal with this issue through legislation, the failure of legislation, moving on to an executive order. And, you know, since the beginning of that executive order, there have been a lot of issues swirling around this in terms of constitutionality. And that's the argument that Attorney General Jeff Sessions made the other day in saying that the administration was going to phase out DACA. Although, as we can discuss, President Trump through various tweets has somewhat complicated the picture a little bit.
But during the campaign, President Trump, then candidate Trump, was saying, I'm going to repeal DACA.
Yeah, although, you know, he's always been a little vague in terms of, you know, sort of saying that, you know, he loves the Dreamers and that he has a big heart. And I think you can kind of see him struggling with the impact of this through his tweets. You know, sort of initially saying he was going to phase it out and then saying he'll revisit it in 6 months and then
calling on Congress
to do something
about
and then telling people not to worry for the next 6 months. And so he's clearly conflicted. It's made things a bit more complicated. But the underlying issue, at least from the Department of Justice under Jeff Sessions, is that this is unconstitutional. They're not going to defend it in court. Which was the assumption that this would have been challenged pretty soon in a lawsuit.
Mm-hmm. Mark Hayward, you reported on this for the Union Leader. What did you find was the response locally?
Well, people are anxious. Many of the DACA people, and there's about 300, a little more than 350, fewer than 400 people from who have used a New Hampshire mailing address to apply for DACA. But once you get your work authorization and your social security card, you're free to move anywhere in this country. So they might be in Maine or Massachusetts, and those people might be here. But they're very anxious right now. They contacted their lawyers to see what they've had to do, and they're hoping that something will happen.
And politically, Mark, what's the response been?
Politically, from both sides of the aisle. People have chimed in. Senator Shaheen, she said that it's heartless and cruel, and she wants Congress to address it. Governor Sununu, he's been more muted when it comes to the adjectives, but he says that Congress should do something, and he wants the children shouldn't be responsible for the actions that their parents took in bringing them here.
Yeah, and we actually have some tape of what Governor Sununu had to say about the Trump administration's decision to repeal DACA. Let's hear what he had to say.
Well, I think that the president sent a clear initiative, told Congress to get to work, find a solution here. You know, something that I've always said is children shouldn't be held accountable for, you know, actions of their parents. They're here, and I think the Congress has to get to work and find a real solution.
So Congress now has a little less than 6 months to meet the Trump administration's deadline or the end of DACA cometh. And here from the NHPR newsroom, it was reported that some advocates for these so-called Dreamers had been preparing for this moment. Dan Barrick, how had they been preparing?
Well, preparing just kind of through sheer practical bureaucratic steps. We talked to a couple immigration lawyers who said their clients anticipating this because of Donald Trump's campaign rhetoric that this would be coming to an act. Simple things like speeding along one's application. Even one lawyer said even just getting a postmark on an application or some kind of formal timestamp on your paperwork prior to the president's statement could, in you know, give you some kind of legal toehold. Whether or not that will hold, and of course, as Dean laid out, the subsequent confusion to Jeff Sessions' statement from the president, the sort of apparently conflicting statements, only kind of adds to that muddle for those folks.
I think the short-term goal is, let's say you are coming up for a renewal of your two-year period, if you get that renewed before the phase-out, you've essentially bought yourself another 2 years. And given how unclear the future is now that Trump has said in that tweet that after 6 months, if Congress doesn't act, he will revisit the issue. We don't know what that means. I think people are just looking to kind of buy time, thinking that it's so unsettled that perhaps it'll come back around some point over the next two and a half years.
And we spoke earlier this week with Ron Abramson, an immigration attorney based in Manchester. He says he's been working with clients protected by DACA in the run-up to this decision to explore their options.
We've, you know, been just trying to sort of prepare people for anything. I mean, one approach was to just get anything that could be filed before this announcement. As a general rule, having a postmark or delivery date before some policy changes at least gives a person potential rights.
So, of course, advocates exploring legal options for people who might be affected directly by the end of DACA. And speaking of legal arguments, states surrounding New Hampshire are making one, and they're suing the Trump administration over ending DACA. That's Connecticut, Vermont, Rhode Island, and Massachusetts. Dan, Dean, I'm not sure if you've heard of this one, but what's the argument for the states now suing?
I think you're going to see additional states sue as well. You know, I think the underlying issue is, how you deal with, having these individuals who are here through no fault of their own. And, I think they're basically going to look to buy time. I think we've heard a number of different states, not just the ones around us, who are threatening to sue as well. Or maybe Dan has something to add in terms of the actual underlying legal argument there.
No, I think it's the same argument that's been made in the subsequent days. The other thing locally you saw too was a pretty unified statement of support for the so-called Dreamers by New Hampshire College and University administrators. Obviously, a lot of the folks who are affected are enrolled in universities across the country. No schools in New Hampshire offered numbers on. And many of them claim that they don't even track that. They don't ask students about their immigration status when they're enrolled. But they all sort of decried the president's statement and pledged to, do whatever they could within the law to support and protect their students enrolled who might be affected by this policy change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you've generally seen the universities come out in support of the Dreamers, of DACA. Some have kind of been bolder. Some universities have been a bit bolder than others in terms of criticism. They sort of want to support the Dreamers. Other universities have, said within the law that they'll do, that they're not going to cooperate, they're not going to make it easy, but they will function within the parameters of the law. So you're seeing kind of some variation, but in general, these individuals are viewed as sort of people who are contributing and going to school, and many of whom have been here virtually their whole lives. And so you see the support that you would expect from universities.
Mm-hmm. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Mark.
Peter, and what DACA did, it gave the children Social Security numbers, meaning that they could enroll in school, because if you try to enroll in school and you don't have a Social Security number, you're not going to go far. Most of the DACA students in schools in New Hampshire are probably in the community colleges. They didn't respond to my request for a statement, but
the community colleges didn't.
No, they didn't. But UNH and Southern New Hampshire both put out statements saying that they want to see Congress act into a pass a Dreamers law. When it came to what you said about attorney generals, remember it was 9 or 10 Republican attorney generals that kind of forced Jeff Sessions' hand on this. They said that they were going to sue if he didn't address DACA. Gordon McDonald is not one of those. I talked to his associate yesterday, and she said that he's not joining either lawsuit, the one by the Republican attorney generals or the one by Northeastern attorneys general.
Mm-hmm. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. We're talking about President Trump's decision to end DACA. We'll be talking about out-of-state voters in New Hampshire later in the show, as well as the opioid crisis and how Manchester is responding, and about the Confederate flag on the mural at Epsom Central School. Do you have insight into one of these stories? Perhaps you are from Epsom and you want to weigh in on the debate about that Confederate flag on the mural. Maybe you want to weigh in on the out-of-state voter data that we just received. Call us now to participate in that upcoming discussion. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post your comments on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. Dan, I wanted to follow up with you about a question about the universities. Maybe you two, Dean and Mark, can weigh in. I mean, aside from making a statement in opposition to President Trump's decision to end DACA, what could a university do to protect students who are enrolled who are Dreamers?
Well, I don't know in terms of protect if a so-called Dreamer is, if we're looking months down the line and DACA continues to be repealed, I'm not sure how many colleges in this country would be willing to actually defy law enforcement. But they could, as Dean indicated, they could take service. I got an email from my alma mater saying that they would be providing immigration attorneys and one-on-one consulting for students enrolled in the school who might be affected. they could provide, you know, some other kind of counseling services. But, you know, Dean indicated this, you know, some of the spectrum, everything from real strong disapproval of the president's statement to saying, you know, we'll do what we can within the law. I haven't seen any colleges or universities nationally that say we will, you know, sort of, you know, daring federal officials to come on campus and take action or anything like that.
Hmm. Same from you, Dean?
Yeah. There's. It sounds like Mark's going to jump in. But, yeah, my sense is there's sort of a range, at a minimum, the suggestions that, you know, that these universities are not going to go out of their way to be cooperative and provide information and that they have in place, protocols for dealing with really any time you have a law enforcement officer of any sort on campus. But also, as Dan mentioned, this idea of providing either legal counsel or other sorts of guidance to deal with this.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I believe Southern New Hampshire is consulting with a immigration attorney, and they've talked before about how they would handle it if ICE wanted to come on campus. I think they would want to see some kind of a warrant or something.
And Mark, I wanted to ask you about another sign of the immigration times that you've been reporting on, which is the fact that the group of Indonesians in New Hampshire received deportation orders. You've been writing about this. What's happening with that group of Indonesians here in New Hampshire?
Right, they came to the country in the late 1990s, and they've lived here for the last 7 years in a kind of precarious situation. ICE has said that they've exhausted all their appeals and that they're eligible for deportation. But for the last 5 or so years, ICE used its discretion and just said, well, you check in on a regular basis and we're not going to do anything, right? But starting last month, they told people when they checked in, you have to come back next month with a plane ticket and you have to start to prepare to be removed to Indonesia. Then this month, another round of people who were scheduled for check-in came, and they were also told you have to leave next month, in a couple months. They're upset. Jean Shaheen, Senator Shaheen, has and Carol Shea Porter, they both taken up this cause. They're in the Dover area, and they've said that they've contacted Homeland Security on their behalf, and they want their deportation stayed. But at this point, it seems like they're going ahead.
So what happens if they don't show up with the plane tickets as they've been required to do? Do they just have to go into hiding here?
That's what you would have to do. They'd be, like anyone, they'd be subject to detention if ICE found them. And so if you got pulled over for a speeding ticket, ICE would take you into detention. They could go to your home and look for your workplace. It seems like they're focusing on these people. So, and most of them, they've been here for decades. They have families, they work, they have houses, they have car payments. It's pretty hard to just go underground and go into hiding after 20, 30 years of living here.
And one point in addition to Mark's summary of the case, these folks describe themselves as members of a persecuted religious community. They're Christians, and they say that in Indonesia, a largely Muslim country, that they would face religious persecution, which is one of their arguments. I believe it's why they were granted this sort of extended, sort of continued renewal of their legal status here over the last 20 years or so, as Mark described. So there's that wrinkle to it, which I think has also helped elevate their cause among certain folks, including the congressional delegation and advocates here in the state.
Well, Mark Hayward of the Union Leader, thank you very much for joining us to provide your perspective on DACA and immigration here in New Hampshire.
It's a pleasure, Peter.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. We're speaking with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, and NHPR News Director Dan Barrick. And if you've got questions about this week's news, something the press did not catch, please let us know. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post on our Facebook page. We've got a live video stream of this show happening now at NHPR Exchange on Facebook. After the break, we'll be talking about the opioid crisis. We'll also be talking about out-of-state voters in New Hampshire and allegations that they have swayed the November 2016 election. So stay with us. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. We'll be right back.
I'm Virginia Prescott, here to tell you that after 8-plus years, word of mouth is ending its run as a weekday show. But I am thrilled to announce a revamped, retooled, and relaunched word of mouth weekend show beginning September 2nd. From now on, we are going local, answering your questions about the state and exploring the culture, history, and geography of the place we call home. Listen in to the new Word of Mouth, Saturdays at 11, right after Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on NHPR.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, here in the studio with NHPR News Director Dan Barrick and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. And it has been a busy week for reporters in New Hampshire. Now is your chance to get some answers to your questions about what's been happening in the Granite State. We'll be discussing out-of-state voters and the specter that some on the right are rising about. People who shouldn't be voting in New Hampshire are actually swaying the elections here. Give us a call about this or other stories in the news this week. We'd love to hear your perspective. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. Again, that number, 1-800-892-6477. You can also email your comments. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. Really looking forward to hearing from you. Okay, so let's talk about the opioid crisis because there have been some developments this week. Dean, the latest on the opioid front is that opioid-related overdoses rose by more than 80% in August compared to a year earlier, but the number of deaths from those overdoses dropped by more than half. So help us understand that, Dean. What does that mean? Yeah.
Well, it's a good question. There are some theories about what's going on here. You know, I think, you know, we've talked about this crisis many times here on the Roundup, and I think it's going to take some time to get enough good data to see if these are longer-term trends or just kind of blips or outliers in the month-to-month data. You know, some people are suggesting that, you know, the ratio between overdose and fatality could be a function of the different kinds of mixes you're seeing on the street in terms of opioids that are gotten illegally. But there are other things going on as well. I think people are sort of more aware now of the dangers of fentanyl, which has been one of the big drivers of overdose fatalities. A lot of cities, Manchester is one we've talked about in particular with its safe program with the first responders where you can go to a fire station, et cetera. That's had a big impact. I think other cities are dealing with that as well. So I think you know, it's a combination of sort of factors that are more street level combined with sort of greater awareness and initiatives undertaken by cities that have been hit by the crisis.
Okay. And meanwhile, the state is sharing with many other states some grant money that could help states track and prevent opioid-involved non-fatal and fatal overdoses. What could this money be used for?
Yeah, it's about, I think, $4.7 million, almost $5 million. We're one of 32 states in the District of Columbia. You can use the money for a variety of things. I think it's going to be used for enhanced toxicology, surveillance, also dealing with medical examiners and coroners, just sort of a variety of different things that will help the state deal with some of the impacts of the crisis.
Another interesting piece of news on this front this week was the city of Manchester announced that it would be filing a lawsuit against a number of opioid manufacturers, including Purdue Pharma, which last month was the target of a lawsuit by the state attorney general. And this is not a new tactic nationally. Obviously, a number of states and even individual cities and counties across the country have filed lawsuit against drug manufacturers, really claiming that they are to blame and should bear some of the financial burden that this crisis has taken, the toll it's taken on first responders, on lost productivity, on medical facilities in the community. The city of Nashua has indicated that too. It may be bringing its own lawsuit, but Casey McDermott reported on this for us, and she pointed out just the bluntness of this lawsuit in the opening lines, the language. I mean, of course, you know, lawsuits are sort of performative documents in some ways. You're trying to make a case and sway public opinion, but really focusing on what the attorneys for the city described as the greed of drug manufacturers through their marketing practices and really trying to push these products that they knew were addictive and could lead to great harm. So we'll see where that goes. But it's been an interesting kind of new front in this crisis. We've gone through the kind of shock of recognition that the toll that these drugs were taking, the policy response at the state level, and as Dean indicated, some of the local responses, safe stations and other approaches, alternate treatments we've been seeing aside from the pure, you know, sort of law and order and traditional recovery programs, and now this sort of growing legal strategy that, you know, could result in several outcomes, but it certainly represents a kind of a new phase in how the state's trying to deal with this problem.
And also this week, Manchester first responders noticed a reduction in use of a different kind of drug, the synthetic marijuana known as spice. Smoking was recently banned in downtown parks as sort of a way to eliminate the use of spice, or at least reduce it. So is this a sign that ban is responsible?
I don't know. I mean, you know, we talked to one of the top fire officials in the city who said that the Board of Aldermen approved this temporary smoking ban in a number of city parks. They recently decided to make it permanent for the next 6 months, and then it will be renewed. You know, it's only been in effect for a few weeks. It's hard to really draw great conclusions. And, you know, I don't know. I think common sense would say if somebody's, you know, how much impact would a smoking ban have if people are making decisions about using illegal drugs? I know some of this data was about the spice, which is this synthetic blend of marijuana. But I think we need more time to really kind of understand the impact of this particular decision.
And we got a question by email from Kevin, who wrote in to say, can either guest speculate how many more ODs are not being reported due to the wide availability of Narcan? He says, isn't it safe to assume that OD numbers are much higher? Of course, never ask journalists to speculate, but we do want you guys to sort of discuss, like, is that a possibility? Like, there are a lot more overdoses happening. We just don't know about it because there's a lot of Narcan out there.
Well, I mean, there's sort of two ways to look at that. On the one hand, in terms of first responders, you certainly have Narcan as an intervention, which brings people back from an overdose. So perhaps that's having an impact on fatalities. On the other hand, if Narcan is more widely available to people, it could conceivably be that people are overdosing and someone with them at the time is using it to revive them. There's not really any way to know, but it's certainly Narcan has certainly had a big impact on fatalities.
But certainly worth bringing up.
Yeah, it's not just in the hands of first responders. I think,
right,
as your questioner is implying, that we know over the last couple of years it's been administered to schools and even individuals. We had a reporter who's doing some work on the new needle exchange program that the state recently adopted. Some of those programs are handing out Narcan when they're handing out clean syringes, and individuals are, you know, I guess if you're savvy enough drug user and have been around a Narcan rescue, then you can administer that to a friend, and that would not be reported.
Yeah, and this has been a little bit controversial. People who oppose one way of thinking about the drug crisis, there are some people who have argued that, you know, if you make Narcan easily available, people know they can kind of push the limit a little bit, and because they have this sort of safety
rescue
net.
Button. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So that's been one argument that's been out there.
Of course, advocates for those who are addicted will say that this needs to be treated more like a disease and less like a moral failing. And that seems to be the philosophy behind these kinds of programs, right? The ones that distribute the Narcan when, for example, they're also giving out needles.
That the priority is to save a life, you know, through the administration of Narcan.
Yeah, okay. Well, this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and we're speaking with our guest today about a variety of stories in the news this week. Later in the program, we're going to be talking about those Great Danes that were taken from a mansion in Wolfboro. They were allegedly living in terrible conditions, and the owner is fighting to get them back. If you have insights into this or questions about that story or something else in the news this week, give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. This was a sort of a late-breaking story in the news this week, but certainly an important one. Recent developments on voting. New numbers came out showing that most people who had out-of-state driver's licenses and voted in the last election, voted legally in the last election, still had not gotten New Hampshire driver's licenses. What was the requirement, Dean, that they do after the election, you know, get a New Hampshire driver's license?
Well, you're technically, you're not required to have a New Hampshire driver's license or even register your car in New Hampshire if you're voting in New Hampshire. You know, the genesis of this is this voting integrity commission that the Trump administration set up to essentially explain why President Trump lost the popular vote by 3 million votes. And the commission's going to do a road trip. They're going to be here on Tuesday, September 12th. There's a series of panels being held at the NHIOP down at St. A's that is going to look at this issue of voter confidence. And you know, this driver's license issue goes back to, I think, a request by Speaker Sean Jasper, who wanted data on out-of-state driver's licenses and car registrations, and sort of trying to match that up with voting. And so there's now this figure out there that there were roughly 6,500 people who voted in the last presidential election with out-of-state driver's licenses, and then of those 6,500, maybe only 1,000 have since gotten New Hampshire driver's licenses. And Chris Kobach, who's the Secretary of State in Kansas, I think he's running for governor. Also, now we know a paid columnist for Breitbart, the conservative website, put out an article on Breitbart claiming that this fact that there are these out-of-state licenses voting is a sign of voter fraud. But you're not required.
He did more
to
than
do
that.
It.
He yeah. said it's he yeah. said it shows
I'm being generous.
That,
yeah.
He shows that Maggie Hessen should not have won last year's Senate. Election because the margin of victory in that race was only 1,000 votes or so.
Right. Assuming you would know how all those people voted.
There's lots of assumptions baked into
that.
So,
and then this initial Breitbart column and the data is now echoed around the sort of conservative talk radio world and various websites. And so this commission is coming into town next week. And I think Bill Gardner was hoping, and he's on this commission, and I've been very critical of that on the show. I think he was hoping that this would be sort of an opportunity to kind of move the argument forward in a nice sort of reflective way. But we now have a statement from Gene Shaheen and Maggie Hassan telling Bill Gardner that he should step down from the commission because it may endanger his legacy. I've said all along that, this is just a really problematic exercise any way you look at it. Whatever comes out of it is just I don't think it's going to really solve whatever issues there are with any voter confidence. And plus, we've been over this issue of voter fraud. There's no systemic evidence. And I've said before, it seems like this whole commission is a function of Trump trying to sort of reverse engineer an explanation for why he lost the popular vote.
Back to those driver's license numbers that Dean's started off with, those 6,500 people who voted in last year's New Hampshire elections registering without out-of-state licenses. There's a lot we don't know about those people. We don't know if they're still in the state necessarily. We don't know how they voted, certainly. But one thing we do know, and I think, it's important to remember this. Dean touched on this. There's no requirement that you have a New Hampshire driver's license to vote in New Hampshire. There's no requirement that you register your car in the state to vote legally in New Hampshire. College students, out-of-state college students who are registered in a New Hampshire college can vote legally in New Hampshire, and they can register to vote with an out-of-state license. So there's absolutely no evidence that of those 5,000-plus people who voted with an out-of-state license, registered with an out-of-state license, and have not since registered secured a New Hampshire driver's license, cast a legal ballot. So there's actually no evidence of that at all, and any implication is just really irresponsible.
Right. Under the law, you can be domiciled here for purposes of voting, but be a resident of another state. Large numbers of – if you look at that, I think NHPR has a useful diagram you can probably find on the website about, sort of where the out-of-state licenses were typically used. It's typically places like Durham, Hanover, Manchester. Yeah.
So those folks, if you're a college student, from an out-of-state enrolled in a New Hampshire university or college, you are perfectly within the law to register to vote on election day or whenever with your out-of-state driver's license, and there's no requirement that then you upgrade that license to a New Hampshire license at any time.
Our number, if you'd like to join this conversation, is 1-800-892-8255. 6477. And let's go to the phones and talk to Stephanie from Portsmouth. Stephanie, thank you very much for calling in. What's your question or comment?
Thanks so much for taking my call. So I grew up working the polls in Durham, and I can tell you that I find these numbers grossly misleading.
Which numbers, Stephanie?
The 6,500 number suggesting that all those people don't have ties to New Hampshire or are voting out of staters voting in New Hampshire. That statistic I have seen now circulating on the blogs and in reports across New Hampshire Today, and characterizing those voters as out of staters is just unjust. It's wrong. In many cases, those are students. They're spending more time in New Hampshire than they may be spending in those states where they were born or where they came from. And ultimately, I think this is yet another attempt to provide justification for a misguided witch hunt of a commission to try and prove voter fraud when we know there's no evidence of widespread voter fraud in New Hampshire. So I just wanted to, having had the perspective of working the polls in Durham, watching what it means to young people to get to show up and register to vote on the same day, what that means for voter participation, the idea that now 6,500 people are characterized as out-of-state voters, that's just false.
Well, Stephanie,
in New Hampshire, they're allowed to vote here.
Yep. Thank you very much, Stephanie. Appreciate your perspective. Let's also talk to Jerry Nurk in Freedom, who's a state rep. Jerry, thank you very much for calling in. What's your question?
Sure. Thank you very much. It's actually Jerry Knurk, and
I'm a
state rep from Freedom. And this story does not have to do specifically with the 2016 election, but I'm sure that it affected thousands of people. We lived in Massachusetts in 2006. Our son started going to UNH in 2006. We moved to New Hampshire in 2007. Though I wasn't able to contact him this morning to find out if he voted in 2008, I would suspect that he probably did. And he did not have a car, so he didn't register a car. He was not driving a whole lot. He didn't change his driver's license. He graduated in 2011 and, like many young people, wandered about for a while, living in New Jersey, Connecticut, and Massachusetts, and then ultimately bought his home in southern New Hampshire in 2016. He's a New Hampshire resident. He was a New Hampshire resident when he voted. And I think that, again, echoing what the previous person who worked the polls down in that area just had to say, this is no sign of voter fraud. He always wanted to be back in New Hampshire, but as a young person, he had some other things he had to do with work.
Understood. Okay, so Jerry Knurk there making the separation between what it means to have a driver's license and what it means to actually be a resident here in New Hampshire. Jerry, thank you very much for giving us a call. So, yeah, I mean, that's one of the issues at the heart of this Kobach article that's gaining traction in right-wing circles, right, that there's some kind of conflation between having a driver's license and having a legitimate interest in voting here in New Hampshire.
Well, it's sort of another gloss on a line we heard shortly after Election Day last year from many folks on the right, including, I believe, Stephen Miller, an advisor to President Trump, that in their words, there is a well-known tradition of Massachusetts folks being, quote unquote, bussed into the state on Election Day, casting illegal ballots and then being bussed out. That claim was widely debunked across the aisle in New Hampshire by folks in politics. I think this we're hearing the commentary on the right coming out of the release of this number seems another version of that, pointing to data to presumably give it a little bit more quantitative heft. But I do think it's just important to remind to make clear current policy, current election law in New Hampshire. There does not imply that there's anything nefarious in those numbers. There's a lot we don't know, but to jump to a conclusion that 5,000 people illegally out of state residents illegally voted on Election Day last year is really irresponsible based on what we know now.
Yeah, and the viral nature of this on social media, Twitter in particular, is just fascinating. The kind of aha moment among conservative outlets that, aha, there's 6,500 driver's licenses from out of state in New Hampshire. So, you know, this is a very kind of conspiratorial tone to the writing, but there's nothing illegal about it. And it's not really evidence of anything. It's just probably primarily college students voting.
And just to be clear, worth mentioning before the break that Bill Gardner said this had no bearing on last year's election.
He said he had no reason to believe that there was anything problematic about the outcome of our election.
All right, worth mentioning. So this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. We're speaking with Dan Barrick and Dean Spiliotis, and with you. If you've got questions about the week's news or comments, please let us know. Give us a call, The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. We've got a grab bag of topics coming up for the last segment of the show. Corey Lewandowski, the Confederate mural in Epsom, Great Danes Kino, First Robotics Northern Pass. We'll get to all of it with your help. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Peter Biello. We will be right back. And this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, here in the studio with NHPR News Director Dan Barrick and Dean Spiliotis, Civic Scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. And with you and your questions, of course, about the week's news. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. Again, that's 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange@nhpr.org. We're just talking about new voter information in the discussion about voters who originate from out of state but do have some legitimate lawful tie to New Hampshire that enables them to vote. I want to take one more call on that topic, and let's talk to John in Manchester. John, thank you very much for calling. What's your question or comment?
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I mean, I was just calling because I'm a Republican and have been, you know, for a long time, and this is an issue that I see discussed very frequently. And I remember when I was a college student in Vermont, I voted there. That was the first time I voted, and I was definitely part of that community. And I don't know, I just feel like this whole push seems like a sort of a partisan identity exercise to go after college kids who are generally viewed as liberal or Democrats. And I don't know. I don't think that it's necessarily anything about any deeply held voting rights beliefs. It's just going after people they think are going to vote Democrat.
Well, John, thank you very much for weighing in on that subject. This is certainly a hot one this morning and hard to leave it alone. Let's talk to Ned in Portsmouth. Ned, thanks very much for calling. What's your question or comment?
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I guess I had a question, a request, if you would have. NHPR, can your reporters not dig a little bit further into this data that's being cited? You know, we're being told that there were 6,500 registrants, 80% of whom never got a driver's license or registered a car. So, okay, there's 5,200 people who, after voting, registering to vote, claiming residence in New Hampshire, never had an association with a car. Well, who's that likely to be?
So more questions about that.
Can we not look at the data and see, without looking at names, can you not look at the column for town? Where did these people claim residence? And if it's in one of the vicinity of Keene or Durham or Plymouth, then there's a high likelihood that these are 5,200 students.
Well, yeah, let's put that to NHPR News Director Dan Barrick to see what reporting plans are on that.
Dean touched on this, and we actually have done quite a bit of reporting earlier this year, mostly around the debate over Senate Bill 3, the new voting law bill. And the caller is absolutely right. Casey McDermott, who's been covering election issues for us, took not this data set. So this was just released yesterday, so we haven't really had a chance to look at it specifically, but looked at a larger historical data voting trends about where out-of-state driver's license are used for same-day voter registration. And the caller is absolutely right. They tend to be clustered in the state's college towns, Durham, Hanover, Keene, Plymouth. And it's kind of intuitive. If you're a college student, likely the only form of ID you have is a driver's license. I don't know if you could say most, but I'm sure many college students don't end up bringing a car with them. And as we said, there's no requirement that if you're attending college in New Hampshire and plan to vote in your local town that you get a New Hampshire driver's license.
Okay, and well, we want to move on from this voting topic, as interesting as it is, but we'll certainly be covering it in the weeks and months to come here at NHPR. But we had a question earlier about the DACA conversation for Dean. Dean, the question was about the origins of DACA back in 2007, 2009. Clarify that for us.
We got an email from Michael, and Michael, thanks for, quote, being that guy. I think I said that the Obama administration introduced the DREAM Act in 2007 and 2011. Now, President Obama didn't take office until 2009, so he couldn't have actually introduced it. But the act was attached to an amendment in 2007 by Illinois Senator Dick Durbin. It was originally introduced going all the way back to 2001 by Utah Senator Orrin Hatch and Illinois Senator Dick Durbin. So the DREAM Act had kind of been in place since 01, 07, right before President Obama ran for election. It came back up. They had issues with the filibuster. But yes, the Obama administration clearly was only behind it in 2011 because he took office in 09. So thanks to Michael for pointing out that inconsistency.
Well, we just want to be absolutely clear. So thanks
absolutely.
Very much. I appreciate
it.
Yeah, thank you very much, Dean, for clearing that up. Okay, yep. So let's talk about Corey Lewandowski because he's going to Harvard now. Dean, why? Why is he going to Harvard?
He's going to be a visiting fellow at Harvard's Institute of Politics at the Kennedy School. Harvard has this program where they bring in a group of fellows, visiting fellows each year. It's typically a mix of kind of people who are sort of winding down a political appointment or maybe lost re-election. Sometimes it's policymakers, other times it's journalists. So Mr. Lewandowski is going to be one of the fellows. I believe it's this fall. You know, he lives in New Hampshire. He's a Lowell, Massachusetts native. Some people may remember that Gene Shaheen was director of the Institute of Politics for a few years in between being governor and winning election to the U.S. Senate. So it's an opportunity for sort of interesting kind of politically or policy relevant individuals to come into Harvard, be part of the scene there, teach some courses, give some public talks. It's interesting, you know, some people have mentioned that in December of 2016, there was a post-election panel at the IOP, and Corey Lewandowski was on it, and it actually turned into a bit of a shouting match. So, you know, sort of the social media world was a little askance. Some, obviously, folks who are not Trump supporters, at why they would pick him, that it seemed like an odd choice. But it's certainly an interesting program, and anybody who does it, you know, seems to enjoy doing it.
I mean, apart from that shouting match, though, this is a little bit controversial, in part because Corey Lewandowski is not, say, as spotless a figure as those New Hampshire senators who have been a part of this institute, the Senator Gene Shaheen and former Senator Kelly Ayotte.
Yeah, it just struck folks who watch this stuff closely as a little bit of an odd pick, and certainly a way to get some headlines. You know, for the other side of the coin, people who are, you know, Democrats and watch MSNBC, Mika Brzezinski and Joe Scarborough of the Morning Joe Show are both going to be visiting fellows as well.
Okay.
The current director of the institute spoke to one of our reporters about this and indicated, you know, Mr. Lewandowski's sort of reputation and character aside, that he saw that there was value to adding, you know, Corey Lewandowski's work on the Trump campaign. I mean, there was a lot of, you know, sort of chin scratching after the election of Donald Trump about what the mainstream media and sort of the political elite and academia missed about the electorate. The director implied that Lewandowski's involvement in as a fellow would sort of fill a hole there, and he would bring a perspective politically and ideologically that was often missing from you know, Ivy League campuses.
Mm-hmm. Also in the news this week, at Epsom Central School, the school board voted to leave in place a mural that featured the Confederate flag. Dean, what was the story behind this mural?
I've seen pictures of it in the paper and on the web. It's a mural of the United States that, you know, sort of the southeastern quadrant of the map. There's a Confederate flag included on the mural, and so there's a discussion now about what to do about that. You know, this is sort of in the context of the larger discussion coming out of the Charlottesville episode and whether or not to take down statues Confederate soldiers. We've also had the issue with the Durham Post Office with the mural that has a Native American in it and talks about cruelty and adversity. I think the issue with Durham is that the post office says that they're not allowed to kind of alter things that are currently in place. This issue in Epsom, I think they voted, it was a close vote, but I think the board had voted to leave it. You know, the big debate over here is, but this more generally is, do you sort of erase this stuff from history because of the negative connotations and the fact that it makes some people, you know, very uncomfortable? Or is there some way in which you can kind of present additional context? I think in the post office case, the post office is offering to put some text or some additional context. And some people have suggested that, you know, that for Epsom, maybe this is a teaching opportunity for elementary school students to put it in historical context.
But according to reports, at least as far as Epsom is concerned, the discussion, it was heated, but the focus was on what's best for the students. Should they be exposed to this kind of stuff? Should they use it as a learning opportunity? That's kind of where the discussion went as far as I
understand. I thought it was just fascinating to hear, you know, this five-member school board in rural New England having a very sober and thoughtful discussion about the image, you know, the Confederate imagery, you know, almost 200 years after the end of the Civil War. Just a very interesting lens on where we are as a country right now.
Certainly. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. We're speaking about the week's news, and we want your input or questions. If you've got them, the number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post your thoughts on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, where we're wrapping up the live stream video of this weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. We've got a few more stories to talk about in the short time we have left. Let's talk about the dozen animal cruelty charges, the new one filed against Christina Fay, the woman accused of neglecting 75 Great Danes in Wolfboro. Dean, what are the new charges?
I think it all has to do with the continuation of the animal cruelty charges that the owner has faced. You know, the issue here that has been ongoing for a while now is a claim by the owner, or the so-called breeder, that these dogs were unlawfully seized, that they're still her property, that she should have a say about whether or not they have surgeries, that she should decide where these 75 dogs should temporarily be housed. The government has argued that, well, this is essentially evidence in the case at a minimum. And then, you know, there's sort of larger issues about, you know, at what point do you kind of forfeit your right to your property based on animal cruelty? And, you know, I'm not sure what argument she's going to make about why she should have control over these dogs. But, you know, the details that we know so far of this are, you know, this sort of huge number of Great Danes living in squalid conditions in this mansion up in the Lakes region. And I'm not sure what the mitigating factors are, given how bad the situation was.
The lawyers are certainly advocating for sort of patience as they try to make their case. But here's what the investigators found: that the dogs had, quoting from a news source here, eye problems, ear infections, pressure sores, papilloma infection, heartworm, conjunctivitis, and moist dermatitis of the feet. So how does that square against Faye's description of herself as an attentive dog owner?
Yeah, I don't, you know, I've been a dog owner for decades, and so I understand a lot of the health issues, and these are very serious issues. You know, she was supposedly a breeder, but, you know, breeders don't typically keep 75 dogs on hand. That's not a very good or well-run, you know, breeding operation. And, you know, they're saying that, well, you know, we have to sort of know the whole story, but, you know, we heard about the feces and the maggots, and all the other issues that go along with it. I'm willing to hear what they have to say, but it sure seems to me like a sort of a classic case of animal hoarding.
Okay. Well, in the meantime, the dogs are getting treatment, as far as I understand. So this will play out in court, but the dogs are, at least for the moment, stabilized. Let's talk about something else this week. The robotics potential at schools here. New Hampshire schools can now apply for grants to start their own robotics team. This was rolled out this week by Governor Sununu and Dean Kamen, but this has been a few years in the making, right, Dan?
It's been a few years in the making. The NHL competition is something that Dean Kamen, who's a well-known figure in business circles and tech circles, not only in New Hampshire, nationally, his first robotics competition has really taken off. you see these pictures of these young kids in these competitions, and it's really quite amazing. This is a fund that I think it's actually existed, I think, since 2014, but it only was recently the state actually put some money in it to allow districts to cover some of the costs, which can be significant for small districts about buying tools and supplies to manufacture these robots, and entry fees for contests. And the governor was involved, which is not unusual in these kinds of things. But it was interesting to see Chris Sununu, who is an engineer by training and Anyone who's observed him in the last, you know, his early months in office, he does seem to get a real palpable thrill from these kinds of, you know, sort of quote unquote geeky kind of science moments. Anything from how maple syrup operations work to these kind of robotic things. So, you know, we'll just kind of see where it goes. But it was a it was a sort of, I guess, a cheery moment in an otherwise fairly bleak news week.
Right, right. So I'd be interested to see what the schools, what the kids come up with and, you know, what their coaches help them with. That'd be fun. Okay, so robotics, that's underway. Let's touch on Keno really quickly because two towns out in the seacoast, Portsmouth and Rochester, made sort of opposite decisions on Keno. What were they, Dan?
Well, right now, so Keno was passed by the legislature just a few months ago. It's the sort of, you know, automated sort of gambling, bingo-ish kind of game that you see in bars and restaurants in some other states. It's tied to kindergarten funding here in New Hampshire. I think we've discussed this on the show before, but it's going to help. It'll increase state grants to local communities. But it's predicated on cities and towns actually have to decide whether or not to legalize Keno within their borders to allow bars and restaurants in their communities to install Keno machines. So right now, the way, you know, New Hampshire local governance works, cities, it'll go on the ballots in the state's 13 cities, if the Board of Aldermen or city councils in those cities decide to approve it. Portsmouth, so far, I believe, is the only city in New Hampshire to have taken action to decide not to put it on the ballot. In some ways, that's not surprising. Portsmouth, you know, is a city that sort of prides itself on having a real kind of squeaky clean tourism image, lots of high-scale, you know, upscale restaurants in town. But we've seen quite a lot of interest in other communities. I believe Nashua, Keene, Rochester now, I think a couple other have decided to put it before voters in this fall in municipal elections. Mm-hmm. Towns will make that choice in the spring at their annual town meetings.
Yeah, and under the law, I believe you don't need to have Keno in order to share in the additional money for kindergarten.
So, you know, lottery officials and lawmakers have been saying, well, you know, passing Keno is great, but to actually see the money, you've got towns and cities have got to legalize it. And they're really looking to bigger communities like Nashua and Manchester, and particularly those along the border. I mean, Portsmouth is one, Rochester is another. They're really banking on attracting out-of-state gamblers to these games.
So really quickly, Dan, will towns get less money if they do not have Keno?
No. Okay. No, it'll be spread.
Whatever there is will be spread around.
Spread across state equally, yeah.
All right, so that's it. This has been the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR, and this conversation continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. We've been here in the studio with NHPR News Director Dan Barrick and Dean Spiliotis of SNHU. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks, Peter.
Thanks, Peter.
And I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening to NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.